New will open. Good morning. We're going to go through our agenda in order today, starting off with a work session on Senate Bill 165. Chris is here with a little bit of a background, how we got there, what we're trying to fix, and some hitches in the system here with relating clauses.
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In OLIS, there is a document called PTE Sectors. And this is some of the information. This is a document I just added to. This was provided back in February, but I thought I would just add to the document just so that we can refresh our memories and so forth. And the PTE is the pass-through entity tax policy that was adopted in the 2013 special session.
Also known as a grand bargain.
Yes.
Love those words, don't we? The gift that keeps giving.
And basically what the policy is, just to refresh everybody's memory, is that for partnerships and S-corps, where one of the owners that operate materially in the business, they're basically involved day-to-day, so it's not just a passive investment. That income can be subject to preferential tax rates. So the first, up here on the screen there, we have our standard joint income tax rates, or they're joint brackets. The rates are the same for all filers. They're 5, 7, 9, and 9.9. And for this non-passive income, it can be pulled out of the return, basically, and taxed at those rates, anywhere from 7% up to the 9.9%, with most of the income up to $250,000 taxed at 7%. So that's potentially a 2 percentage point reduction in the tax.
Mm-hmm.
So that's this is the policy that we're talking about. The preliminary revenue impact for 2015, for the most part, the estimated revenue impact was $100 million a year. And the first year in 2015, it was about 70% of that total. And the information is still, DOR is in the close to finalizing the information. I don't think this has changed that much. I just don't have final data, so I'm just using this old data. And this raises the question of whether or not the revenue impact will change in future years. And I'm not inclined to change that revenue impact just yet because of all of the feedback we got regarding this impact. Even though it was 70% of that, we heard from a lot of CPAs and so forth that were a lot of taxpayers who weren't aware of it and weren't able to claim it in time. So we're still looking at about $100 million revenue impact per year. And then we provided information on the number of businesses and the number of entities per return. For example, the entities per return, most people belong, they'll have one business. So, for example, in that table, 87% of this sample of 500 returns indicated there was one business. But some taxpayers had up to five businesses. So it gets pretty complicated whether we're talking about individual taxpayer returns or the business. So you can have a partnership that consists of five partners, and then that one business will show up on five different tax returns. So part of that mapping, it adds to some complexity in understanding the impacts. If we bounce down to the third page, this is where we get to some of the economic sector information. So as we've been going through this policy over the past year, under the category of trying to improve an existing policy as opposed to some of the other more ambitious efforts.
And we're trying to improve it because we had considerable testimony that the people who benefited here were not lawyers and doctors, and nothing against lawyers and doctors, but that they weren't creating the jobs that was originally intended here. So that's what we're trying to fix.
Correct.
I wish Senator Brokus were here, but he was helping. He's kind of driving the train on this and saying, well, why don't we specify specific industries to target here in order to qualify industries and occupations that don't include being an attorney in Portland.
Mr. Chair. Chris, could you refresh my memory of what criteria you had to meet to get this? It was an employee criteria of some sort?
You had to have at least one employee. you had to materially participate in the business, which is defined in federal statute, basically involved in the day-to-day. And the employee, there were some hours requirements. It was either 1,000 or 1,200 hours per year, but it was just you had to have at least one employee.
Okay.
And the drafted bill, 165, would require a growth in that employment over time. But as the chair was just describing, the policy focus on getting back to the original idea of creating jobs and focusing on those sectors that did, because there were a lot of, we heard from a lot of businesses that became eligible for it, but they didn't add any jobs. They didn't expand the economy in any way, if you will. So that's where we have the idea of focusing on economic sectors. And we were trying to get an amendment drafted for this morning that either focused on, we were going two different ways. One on traded sectors, which is a kind of a broad term. And then we had another amendment focusing on specific sectors. But Ledge Council informed us that neither of those would fit into the relating clause for Senate Bill 165. So we're just talking about it in terms of a conceptual amendment right now. And we're looking for another bill that the policy could be put into. So the economic sectors we have here, that first table shows the distribution of the businesses that were reported on the tax returns, where most of them were in the professional, scientific, and technical services. This is probably where the, for the example, lawyers are. But the policy approach we were taking was focusing on three sectors, basically ag, mining, and manufacturing, these being the traded sectors where the tax reduction could be put back into the business to create jobs and help grow the economy, if you will.
They can't mine anymore.
So that's basically where we're going here. So the impact, what we're looking at is, if we look at the shares there for ag, it was about 7% of the entities, and manufacturing about 7% of the entities. So I'm still working through relating the number of returns to the impact. So, but as a first blush, we're looking at an impact that would be maybe 20% of the initial impact.
Okay. And the relating clause for Senate Bill 165 is relating to employment requirements for elective reduced rate of taxation on pass-through incomes. About as narrow as you can get, so I can understand.
Well, in we have ongoing conversations with Ledge Council, and that one they feel is too restrictive, but Senate Bill 164 may work.
What is that relating clause?
That relating to clause is to the election of reduced rate of taxation on pass-through income. So it's the election of the rate. They're still considering it, so I don't want to speak for Ledge Council.
Okay.
But
this is not an insurmountable problem. We'll find a bill. We're trying to amend the grand bargain bill, Senator Boquist, and we the relating clause and is a little bit too narrow, according to LC. On the
that doesn't surprise me because they haven't been able to
unscrew three of my relating clauses to start with, and they wrote them, and I didn't change them. So not surprising to me that there would be an error.
On this conceptual amendment, Chris, if we go to ag and manufacturing, is there also a minimum number of jobs, or did we get there, or is that a policy choice that we have to add in?
That would be an additional policy choice, Mr. Chair. The amendment we are taking now, it's kind of one input at a time. So this amendment would be just the requirement that the employment and the business operate in one of these three sectors. You can certainly add other requirements, even the initial Bill 165 that requires a growth in the employment, a net increase.
Yeah.
Could be kept as well. So you definitely have different building blocks here that you could piece together the policy that you would like to implement to improve and focus the existing policy.
Senator Taylor?
I was just curious if there's ever a percentage of whatever the growth is, instead of having them keep it all, maybe in proportion to how many employees they add or something like that.
That certainly could be, you could explore that.
Well, I mean, I don't know how, because I don't know the distribution of how much people are benefiting from it. So if somebody's getting a considerable amount and they're adding one employee, then obviously that's not the intent of the bill.
Or currently zero employees.
or zero employees, then that was not the intent. Not
necessarily adding any employees. Is that, just have to have one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in terms of increase, you can go year over year. You can add, it can be anything from add at least one employee or add 10% of the employees. Because we'll have a business with that maybe has three employees and a business that has 300 employees. So the percentage approach, which I think is what you're getting at, we can certainly.
This is something to be considered by others. I'm just bringing it up.
Senator Bowe.
Also keep in mind, I mean, we seem to be infatuated by the employee concept, which during, since I was in the grand bargain, right, employees was one of the issues, but I think my good colleague from my caucus would say one of the other fundamental issues here is simply business expansion and business development. And that is are you reinvesting your money? Section 179 stuff for small people. I mean, are you sustaining the business in Oregon? And that's really, I mean, the default, even in the grand bargain discussions, and Dr. Warner can correct all of us if I am, I don't remember, and if he and I can't do it, then we'll get Senator Burdick and Senator Byer and we'll figure it out. But the issue was not really just jobs. The issue, because job creation is, of course, what we're wanting to do. But, you know, job creation this year might also mean that you overhauled and brought in new machinery in your plant. And many of the successes that we've seen on the existing case, not doctors and lawyers, I get that, just for the record, we know, okay, is that, you know, we've had people come in and utilize funding that came out of this and a combination of others to put in, you know, green energy power plants and things like that, which of course then leads to job creation farther down the line. So it's not just jobs. Mm-hmm. The question is we, you know, it was never intended, that's why it doesn't include passive, it was never intended, you know, for people just to profit the money, stick it in their deal and run out the door. It had to have either infrastructure and building development like the Section 179, but in a larger scale, or the job creation. It was both of those in tandem.
That's a fair point.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
No, I was just gonna say, and that's another option in all of the discussions that have been had over the past however many months or years, is making it future use of it contingent upon the tax benefit being reinvested in the business. You can get into a timing issue, because if in tax year 2015 somebody got a tax cut, and then it's possible that for them to be eligible for a tax cut in 2016, that benefit had to be reinvested in the business. I mean, that's another policy option that's been discussed.
How do you write that? How do you know that somebody who saved $20,000 is getting the kind of things that Brian Senator Buck was talked about?
That's a good question, and why we don't have language yet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an idea out there getting at some of the core initial purposes for it. How do you draft the language, and then how do you make it so that the Department of Revenue could administer it? Because there's always a trade-off between fine-tuning and policy and making it more complicated and having it still be administrable. I'm not sure that's a word.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Tress. So for some of the examples that Senator Bocas were bringing up, aren't there other tax benefits for some of the investments that he's bringing up in those examples? I mean, some of the equipment purchases, things like that, doesn't that then put that on a scale for depreciation and other things? I mean,
yes, there all business investment is
I'm glad you are, because actually you're a very good participant in this, and what we just see is trying to get you up to speed here.
One of the
interesting, to answer your question, because this has actually come up before in the last sessions, and in that is that one of the fundamental problems that exists today, and I just had seven bankers in my office that was banking week or something. Good news is only one national bank, because I guess you don't know, but everybody else knows that, you know, none of the national banks like me. So Wells Fargo had enough guts to come to my office this time, which was good, and I appreciate it. And I was very kind to them and worked with that, and the community bankers were there too. But the because of the federal banking regulation changes and everything, the challenge is having the capital. And so the problem with what we found previously with the tax credits and all the things that we normally do in that is that the bank says, and the federal government has said, you got to have X amount of equity. It's not like you can now go borrow zero. You know, you have to have 10, 20, 30% in cash before you're in that cash equity under the new federal regulations before they allow you to borrow the money to go do these developments. And so the federal government and the banking industry, and it's not the banks, it's the federal government setting this, doesn't allow the leverage we used to have. And so those tax credits and stuff that we see as a benefit aren't allowable for them when they start trying to borrow the capital to actually go build these things. And that's the problem we were facing, which is how we ended up where we were at.
Follow? However, aren't they allowed to have, in theory, they should also be getting investors at that time if they don't have, that's an option for them in order to grow.
Well, now I'll just make a brash political statement. Who in their right mind would invest any money in Oregon, okay, with all of our laws?
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the hardest things to determine in all this is the but-for question. When we make investments and we see growth, would that growth have occurred but for this investment? And that's a really difficult thing to understand and to know. In fact, it's almost impossible. And that's one of the conundrums that we have.
Yeah, because at least you can count jobs or employment.
Right.
With the other business purchases are a little squishier.
Yeah, but at least you can't. But the thing of it is that, you know, and again, at least two of us have argued this before, is you can still count the other. I mean, it's Section 179 option or any one of the capitalization options are all in your state and federal tax returns, so you can count those. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing most of us might be in agreement is that when it comes to certain service sectors like doctors and lawyers, okay, there just isn't any way to count that one, okay?
Yeah.
So, and that was raised previously. And to be fair, which I'm normally not fair when it comes to this topic, by the way, is that in the discussions we had, and this is mainly for Chris, and Paul's going to have to help him out later, I mean, there were some fairly substantial legal issues raised about how you could segregate these groups apart. And that is sort of the, I guess, the icing on the cake where it was determined it has to apply to everybody. I had not heard of the option of either using NAAQS codes or stuff previous, but in our previous discussions it was exactly as I think two of you said, Chris, well, how would you write this thing? And there was a lot of, I think, legal pushback and, you know, I don't recall whether it was classes or what it was, but there was significant pushback. There's just, you can't, these people have to get it if the other people are going to get it. Mm-hmm. Now that seems to be either, and we could have blown over, because I don't recall actually having legal counsel in the room any time when we had those discussions. So it could have been sort of members and people talking. But Chris is right. I think there's exactly how you write something like that might be challenging. And I don't know whether it is or not, because.
Senator Birdsugar.
Chris, what was the first year this was available? 2016?
2015.
So it was retroactive? Or when did we do the grand bargain?
2013.
Beyond the three-year limit.
Well, I'm absolutely amazed. We've been talking about this for 20 minutes, and Senator George hasn't flown through those doors yet.
Okay, so we will look for an amendment. Senator Boquist will work with Chris and Paul and me on getting this attached to either Senate Bill 164, or if need be, we can get a new bill from the Senate President. Okay, so I'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 165 and open a work session. I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 165, and I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 311. This is the Senator Roebling seismic retrofit. Can you give us a brief refresher? Kyle?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 311, we do have the Dash 2 amendment, which makes a couple of clarifying changes to the Dash 1, but it's largely the same changes. But yeah, just as a quick overview, Senate Bill 311, it provides a permissive authority to cities and counties, and the city and county also needs essentially a buy-in from local governments to some extent, up to 75% of the local taxes being imposed, to agree to put in place a property tax exemption program available to properties that are being seismically retrofitted that are built prior to, I believe the date is 1993. So the committee heard a lot of testimony about the unreinforced masonry buildings, and those are the primary ones that will probably be in need of retrofit. I guess it's fair to say. So the property tax exemption, the way it's structured, it's a 15-year exemption. It can be a full or partial exemption. And it's equal to, it's for the improvement of the property, not the land value of the property. And the exemption is equal to up to the cost of the retrofit itself. So if the costs are, say, $1 million, then the property tax exemption over that 15-year period cannot exceed that $1 million. The bill also includes, with the next two amendments as well, broad authority to the cities and the counties when they're adopting these ordinance resolutions to put into place further restrictions that are tightening it beyond what's in the measure. So there's a lot of, flexibility in the ultimate program that would be adopted. And for that reason, I can go through the revenue and the fiscal impact statements if you'd like at this time. So the fiscal, we do have the paperwork on that one. there is expected to be fiscal impacts for either the city or the county that's adopting this, just in the administration of it. However, there is contained within the bill abilities of city and counties to charge administrative fees to cover their costs there. So there could be a balancing of the actual cost to administer it with the fee that's imposed. There's also a fee available to the county assessor to help administer the exemption program. On the exemption side of things, again, it's a permissive exemption program, so there's no direct revenue impact from passing the measure, because it would require the cities or the counties to then take the next step of designing this program. However, in the revenue impact did try to give some indication of what these costs could expect it to be. Now, of course, this will depend upon the number of cities and the size of the city or the county that adopt these things, but based upon the availability of the properties that are out there that could qualify for this, the costs associated with upgrading the properties, retrofitting them, it would certainly be expected that the losses in this case could be in several million dollars to even tens of millions of dollars per year. So we did want to include that information to give you some indication of the scope. Again, it depends upon the local adoption, but there are plenty of properties out there that are in need of retrofit, and the costs to that are pretty high. And we do have, there is documentation from the city of Portland as well that puts numbers together based on just within the city of Portland itself, and they have costs ranging $800 to over $1 billion in total retrofit costs. And then also, this does create a new property tax exemption, so I do have a policy purpose statement up there for your review. Happy to receive any comments. We can get that tweaked if you'd like, but that's included in the revenue impact statement as well.
Great Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. Any questions, Kyle?
I just a clarification, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I recall during some of the previous testimony there was discussion about the impacts and the ability to do X, Y, Z without special districts or educational districts from having input, and that's just for the record, slightly incorrect. This was modeled. In reading the language, it's modeled after the Brownfield, which is modeled after the bill we passed, which the only way to get to the 75% mark is you have to have the school district. We did the research across the state, and there's just simply no place that you can't do it, because school is such a large function of that. So it does have to have broader, even though it's permissive, it has to have broader input. I just want to make sure we realize that if we're going forward. Are we going forward? Is that the point?
That is.
That's the point. This is 311.
Dash twos.
Is it dash twos? Any other discussion? Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash twos to 311 dated 4. I'm looking for the 324-17.
Senator Boquist moved the dash twos to Senate Bill 311. Discussion?
Joint tax.
Senator Riley.
So I'm all in favor of allowing the cities and counties to do this. I'm concerned about the impact on schools, and I'm also concerned that when we sometimes give them permission to waive taxes, they come back and ask us to help cover that. I will be a yes, but I wanted that on the record.
Thank you. Further discussion. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the dash twos are in.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 311 to the floor as adopted by the dash twos with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 311 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Are there any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 311 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Does anyone want to
Senator carry Roblin this?
Roblin was the
sponsor of the bill. Yeah, so it's his bill to carry.
Well, I was just giving deference to members of the committee.
I don't think at least several of us don't want deference.
Senator Roblin will be the carrier. All right, we'll close that one out and go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 849.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 849 would establish a first-time home buyer savings account act, and it would permit an individual to create a savings account for the purposes of buying a home for the first time, and the amounts in the account would pay or reimburse qualified beneficiaries eligible costs for the first-time purchase of a single-family residence. The amount would be exempt from taxation. The amount of interest that was made in the account would be exempt from taxation, and subtraction would be allowed for the amount that was contributed to the account, and it could be used for certain expenses related to the purchase of a home for the first time. And the measure applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2018, and before January 1st, 2024.
Okay. Sean Cleave.
Chairman Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors in support of Senate Bill 849. Generally, the bill is conceptually provided to incentivize more people to purchase homes. That's the short version. As the mechanisms of the bill provide, an individual or a couple could take out an account. They could save over a 10-year period up to $50,000 for a purchase of a home. Based on current median prices in the Portland area, this would be a little bit shy of a traditional loan. However, it probably would provide, all things being equal, opportunities for certain lending products that would be available for first-time home buyers. It's modeled somewhat similarly over the college savings plan. However, there is no federal analogous. This would be a state standalone program. Some of the reasons that a bill like this has been brought before you is first-time home buyers are the lifeblood of a good, healthy housing economy. Without first-time home buyers, individuals like myself and my wife, who find ourselves with three children approaching teenage years and we are running out of bathrooms, we would lack the necessary purchasers to be able to move up into the second home. About 10 years ago, the Oregon was around 64% in home ownership. We've retained in the low 60s currently. However, at that time, 10 years ago, 42% of homeowners were first-time home buyers. In 2015, the market was only 32%. So first-time home buyers has dropped significantly. There's a variety of reasons for that. Lending has tightened due to the economy, the housing crash in 2008. Individuals that are in the position to purchase their first home are also finding other debts encumbering them, such as student loans. But put pretty simply, the bill before you provides a strong incentive for individuals or couples to start saving for their home. Some of the differences, however, between this bill and a college savings account is the account can only be held for 10 years. That is provided so that people are earnest when they're saving and that they execute after they are able to save up for that purchase of a new home or for that down payment. some of the opponents of the legislation have said that this would just be a savings account for the rich. I absolutely disagree. A couple of products that are out there in statutory is the individual development account. Individual development accounts are very similar to this. They are targeted at people who earn 80% of the area median income, so a lower income. The difference between IDAs and this program is that the IDAs provide opportunity for matching deposits from nonprofits. So for lower income people using the IDA, that ability to match from nonprofits accelerates their ability to save. However, 80% AMI, especially given our current housing situation in Oregon, that program is underutilized. On the high end, for individuals who would purchase a home, they wouldn't use this program. High income earners would go in with a down payment based on savings or maybe a gift that was provided from a family member to make a purchase. I just don't see a hypothetical situation where maybe a family member would set up an account to make deposits over a 10-year period when, you know, the true rich would actually be able to just execute on a purchase through a gift, or anybody who had the income individually to make that purchase without a program like this. I feel really great about the work product that has been put together. Thank you, Senator Haas, for championing this bill in the Senate. And with that, I will open to any questions you might have. And actually, before I do that, there is in OLIS a economic study that we commissioned. It was a third-party economic study that was provided through a firm that has assisted other states in adopting similar programs. They've gotten pretty good, actually, of modeling what the cost and who would utilize the program. That economic study demonstrates that over a 5-year period, about 3,200 Oregonians would participate in the program. There would be a small cost up front, but over that 5-year period, the estimation based on the economic modeling is that the state cost for the program would be about $3.2 million over a 5-year period. That would not be a biennial expense. The economic stimulation, however, over purchasing a house, whether that's people building, which in the model there's a very small group of people that would purchase a brand new home. Primarily, it would be used by people who are purchasing an existing home, a starter home. But when a purchase happens, there is an addition of spending, roughly about $2,400. That could be a new kitchen or a new appliance, a new couch, a variety of things. So there is some economic stimulation that comes from a bill like this. And the modeling demonstrates that over that same 5-year period, about $4.4 million, if I recall correctly, in tax revenue would be created through either capture through income tax or various other local tax models, such as the document recording fee. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will conclude my testimony now and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. We knew you had teenagers because we could see the gray cropping up in your beard. And I think it's important to point out this is it's first-time home buyers. It's absolutely not the investors. It's not the house flippers. You get one shot.
Absolutely correct. First-time home buyers, however, I will point out that we are using a federal definition based on the 2010 federal tax credit program that was provided to incentivize. So currently, as the bill is defined, it would be people who haven't owned a home for the last 3 years, which there's a lot of people in that situation currently. However, based on the modeling, it is mostly people in the mid-20s to early 30s, the traditional first-time home buyers.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many home builders now are not building as many homes as they can possibly build?
Senator Haas, Senator Riley, that's a fair point, and you had raised the question in the earlier committee. It is very difficult, given the homegrown nature of the housing building community in Oregon, to keep up with supply. Oregon actually has never been in a supply
or oversupply curve, because of a variety of reasons, lending, our land use system, et cetera. Primarily, though, and based on the economic study, the individuals that would be utilizing this would be purchasing existing homes. The model predicts over that five-year period only 101 homes would be built as an avenue for individuals to purchase their new home. So pivoting a little bit on your question, Senator Riley, whether it's a purchase of a new home or a purchase of an existing home, the great benefit that comes from a bill like this is the acceleration of people going into housing, which provides more opportunity for additional rentals. And since the model shows such a small amount, I think that the concern over whether you incentivize the building isn't necessarily the point of the legislation. The point of the legislation is provide that incentive so that people do save and purchase their first home. Does that answer your question, Senator?
No.
Okay.
So you said people move into existing homes.
Yeah.
Those existing homes have to become vacant because somebody moved into a new home. Those new homes don't exist. I don't know what this, I have no clue what this is going to achieve other than people who don't have enough money to put in a savings account now having another place that they cannot put their money.
Senator Riley. Senator Haas, Senator Riley, a strong housing market includes everything from the McMansions down to rentals. It's called filtering. So for people that are in my family situation, providing the opportunity for us to move up without a massive amount of equity in our home, we've owned our home for 8 years. We've done fairly well by being diligent in our financing. Without the opportunity for somebody to purchase our home, we wouldn't have the equity to move up. And the domino effect all the way up and all the way down works in that favor. I don't believe this bill creates a lot of new housing, and that is specific in the specific to the model that is provided in the economic study. However, hypothetically, it may encourage more building for my opportunity to move up and then somebody to move into my house based on the study.
When you put your house on the market, there'll be people coming there offering you more than you ask in the market we have currently. It happens daily.
Questions, comments, Senator Boquist?
I wish that in all of 36 counties of Oregon that, you know, when you put your house on the market, it just magically got snapped up at 30 or 40% higher than it is. But the reality is in rural Oregon, that's simply not true. It is, of course, as the good senator pointed out, true in the metropolitan area and a few of the larger places because there's a shortage. But actually, more to the point, I think.
Well, it's true now. It wasn't true 5 years ago.
Exactly. And, of course, In an economic downturn, which is due to come shortly as a simple market correction, we may be back to where we are before. So it is a cyclic dialectic of the economic model and the reality. But I think staff can also want to point out what I really think needs to be on the record is that Oregon, despite everything we're saying, has a net in-migration. And even if you have individuals moving from one house to the next, generally speaking, the growth is still there. So. Though it's very hard to model, the simple fact is that more people are coming to Oregon than are leaving, and we do have a housing shortage that is there. And at the same time, we know that we have individuals, despite, the Oregonian is best at it. The economy's soaring, but there's a problem. I'm not sure the economy's soaring. And I took issue with their article, but they wouldn't change it. So. But having said that, I mean, the issue still boils down to is we have a whole bunch of people still on assistance programs across the board at record heights at supposedly the same time we're growing. So I don't think I have a position one way or other necessarily right here, but I think anything we can do to increase home ownership in any manner whatsoever that isn't detrimental, we need to do because homelessness, of course, hasn't gone down in the
in all of the metrics that we have out there, despite the, quote, Oregonian soaring economy, unquote.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. I obviously want to support people getting into a home, into their first homes, et cetera. I'm just trying to understand, you keep talking about this analysis, and I'm looking for it here. I'm trying to understand what you're envisioning, how much money someone can save. I mean, the basic economics, I guess I'm questioning, because someone still has to pay rent wherever they are. And then to set aside money on top of it, that has been a struggle since all over the world to buy a home. It's nothing unique to the United States, and it's a continuous struggle. So how much, what kind of analysis, or what are you based on? I mean, if people can't afford it, how can they pay rent and then save for the house, and how will this really alter that fundamental issue?
Sure. Senator Hass, Senator Taylor, very good question. I think that gets to the heart of the concept in front of you. It is very difficult for a family that is living in a rental unit to make rents and save. So looking at Oregon's tax code, how do you create a program that provides an additional incentive to create home ownership? Oregon has the second highest income tax in the nation. We have an exceptionally regressive income tax, too. You're paying 9% on your first, after you earn your first, I think, $8,500 in income for the year. The staff could correct me if I'm off on there. So that being the case, we also have traditional savings accounts that would be provided that are flexible enough for you to make deposits and also make payments without penalty. You know, you wouldn't want to lock up your money in a long-term investment, not even a CD for a home savings program. So to the extent that you're encouraging somebody to save by the interest rate that's earned in a traditional savings program, it's probably not enough to incentivize more savings. Mm-hmm. But through the Oregon Income Tax Code as provided here, provision that allows you to subtract deposits from your earned income is quite an additional incentive. That being said, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And I think that's one of the reasons why, despite, I think, a really good concept, only about 3,200 additional Oregonians would use this as a pathway for additional home ownership. But to Senator Boquist's statement, this is a toolkit, given the housing crisis. We have just a laundry list of factors that are contributing to fewer homeowners. But there is a great benefit, a great social benefit to home ownership that is connected to higher performance for children in school, less behavioral issues, greater civic involvement. And this bill provides another tool in the toolkit to incentivize home ownership by providing that subtraction.
Okay. No further questions or comments. And that study that you mentioned is on OLIS.
That's correct, sir.
Thank you. Jody Weiser.
Senator Hass, members of the committee. Home ownership is absolutely the primary way to building any equity for most families. It is. I mean, the people who retire with $150,000 worth of equity almost always own a house, and that's almost always where their equity is. And so home ownership is clearly an important goal of our organization, because we want some greater equality and wealth. However, this program is designed without any of the security steps that the 529 program has, but it's going to end up, I think, benefiting people in the same way the 529 program benefits the wealthiest 20% of our taxpayers. They're the ones that have money to save. They're the ones that can come up with $5,000 or $10,000 a year to put into a savings account, and they are the most likely homeowners in the state that we have. And what we're basically doing if we approve this bill is saying that we'll contribute $4,500 to the first house of any couple that saves money with this plan. Furthermore, they're doing it not through the treasurer's office, where they would have great, they would have bigger gains on their savings while they were investing, but at banks where there's almost no interest being earned on the account while it sits there, and where we really aren't, where we don't have safeguards to make sure that it, that the money is used as it's supposed to be used, etc. There's a 10% fee, but there's no way of knowing if that's really happening because the banks aren't being required to do much reporting at all as a part of the legislation. So Mr. Cleve mentioned the IDA program. That's true. That is a place where some people save some money for home ownership. And if you look on their webpage, you will see a set of three small units that were purchased by people who used the IDA account to save for their for a home. And our IDA program is capped at $7.5 million a year. This program has no cap. And so we've capped what we will do to help people who are saving, low-income people will do to save to go to college or to buy a car or to get their car repaired or to buy a home at $7.5 million a year. And yet this program has no cap at all, and there's, it's impossible to know what the annual cost would be, but I would bet it would be more than this amount.
Okay.
I think that most families that will use this, whether it's parents putting money into the account or the people who are going to be the account beneficiaries putting money into the account, they're families who actually will get to home ownership without the state's assistance. We hope that we'll at some point see House Bill 2006 be revived, and that would provide significant money to help with first-time home buyers, and it would put our help with the people who have the hardest time getting a down payment together rather than the people in our communities have the easiest time getting the money together for a down payment. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. I appreciate your comments. I'm reading this book, Nudge. It's been pretty popular. That feels like this is a nudge to people to get them into a home.
It's a pretty big nudge. $4,500 is a lot of money to nudge with. You know, money put into an account, whether it's an investment account or a savings account, grows tax-free until you take it out. That's a nudge that exists. I think that it's like all the benefits that we use when we fill out our tax forms. If it's there, we're going to use it. It doesn't necessarily change your behavior.
Okay. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Thank you.
No.
Thank you.
John Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee here, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of this fine bit of public policy. I wasn't planning on testifying, but when Senator Riley asked his questions, I thought I perhaps could come up and shed some light, at least from the new home builders' perspective, on why we think this is a good bill. And Senator Riley, I believe you were asking, are all builders building as many houses as they can?
Mm-hmm.
And the short answer is no. There's a lot of new production that's not happening for a variety of reasons, some of which are within the scope of the legislature's authority, others are not. But my guys are built, we're underbuilding, as you've heard in other conversations. But there's a part of those factors are we do not have enough builders. Part of the reason we don't have enough builders is because the recession, and we're still building our way out of that in terms of our internal structure. Our membership statewide used to be close to 6,000 members. We're now kicking around 2,800. And that's a direct result of the recession's effects. Builders, building and construction are migratory fields. They can go to other states where the economy was less damaged. And we're still recreating that base. So that's kind of problem number one. We don't have enough actual contractors in the business. We don't have enough labor in the business. And you've heard in other committees the need for CTE, career technical education, other things to get people into the trades. If you talk to any of the skilled trades in particular, they're going wanting. So that's a big factor. Lending is a problem. You've heard about this and others. There's not much the state of Oregon can do about that, but banks used to loan on construction dirt acquisition, we call it. Now they don't for a variety of reasons, some of which are more understandable than others, frankly, but that's a limiting factor. But the other big factor, and I actually looked on our National Association's website, but unfortunately the data I need is behind a paywall, so once I get that unwound, I'll be happy to post it to OLIS. One of the limiting factors is a lack of buyers. And a lack of buyers is caused by current consumer debt, is caused by income levels not being sufficient to match up with house prices and so on. But that lack of buyers then feeds those other factors. If we had more people putting pressure on the purchasing side of new construction, that would then free up more inventory as people sell and buy new houses. And that would bring, frankly, builders into the state. Oregon has never historically had national builders. We are part of it, I think, because of our land use system being just so goofy that if you're D.R. Horton, why do you want to try to figure it out? But now Horton is here. Lennar is here. David Weekly Homes is here. They picked up Polygon recently. Polygon is a local builder, brought them out. There's another couple, two or three national firms that are taking down dirt. Those national firms self-finance. They're not necessarily tied to bank financing. They have their own ways of financing builders, but they still need buyers. So to answer your question, long answer to a short question, is there's a lot more capacity we could be producing. In the market, we could be producing that if these other pieces would line up. The one in front of you is a critical part. If you give potential home buyers a little extra source of revenue that they can set money aside and save for with tax benefit, why wouldn't you, I guess is my question. I hope that helps. And I should mention also that, and I've heard from this in other committees, talking about the bills benefit the top 20%, yeah, that's a good talking point. The problem is top 20% is anybody making over $84,000. So we're really not talking about this being a boon to the super rich, unless your definition of super rich counts $85,000. So with that, I'll be glad to take any other questions. Hope that was helpful.
Yes. Question, Senator Riley?
Yes. Actually, not questions. I actually agree with almost everything you said.
I won't tell anybody, Senator Roy.
Almost.
I won't leave it at that.
Be careful.
No, we've agreed before once. So, I do agree. You know, there is possible more capacity for building, but all those other limiting factors are not this one. This one is very little of that, because we have lots of buyers, or we have, as you know, right now it's a seller's market. We're selling houses almost as fast as they can be produced, and so you know this is not going to help that, you know, that much, if anything. I'm not opposed to this because it doesn't hurt much. It hurts a little bit, and we shouldn't be doing, you know, 1,000 cuts when we don't have any place left to cut. But, you know, this is not an awful bill, but it's not a great bill either.
Senator Buckwist.
I just want to, I don't disagree with Senator Riley in terms of his district in the metropolitan areas, but in my district, which surrounds all of those places with 84,000 plus salaries, the housing situation is significantly different.
Yep.
Significantly different. I fully agree that there's a crisis, and it's, but at least in three of the districts, there's a crisis here. Probably in my good senators from my caucus's district and my district, other than Grants Pass and his district, it's 180 degrees. There's, the economy hasn't recovered, and
right.
And the reason the houses there aren't selling is people can't save enough money for a variety of reasons, or earn enough money and save enough money to make the down payment. If something to come in, and I hate to tell the builders this, it probably wouldn't help them as much as they think it would, because most of the people that would use this are going to be more rural Oregonians, and they're going to have to buy a house that's out there, and you know, there's just not the upper scale that's out there. I mean, it would, of course, help the economy, which would help build it, and then, you know, there would be housing construction in your guys' areas. But I see this as a low-income rural area, because I would have to agree. I mean, the person that's making more than $84,000 a year, you know, is probably already saving enough money to, you know, put it aside to go buy a house or to work with one of the new builders, which is unique, where they don't have to use financing companies. But this is, you know,
if this is to work, it's probably going to work less in the metropolitan areas, all the big cities, and work more in rural Oregon.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may, is it actually going to help in your district? That's, if it is actually going to help in your district, I'm for it.
Yeah, I think in the rural parts, yeah, my district, yes. But I mean, just to give you a blunt example, I mean, it's not going to help in a place, for the most part, like McMinnville in my district, which is my one larger city,
right.
Which, of course, is to some extent, though it has an independent economy and a standalone economy, is a subset of Washington County and the metropolitan areas. But in the rest of my cities, I mean, something like this will help. And in the rest of the rural areas, it'll help because, you know, it's an incentive. You know, the trick here is that, you know, I hate to say this, the trick here is to get to the H&R Blocks and people like that so that they can, because, I mean, the people in my district don't go to a CPA. I'm guessing most of us have a CPA of some sort, you don't. Okay. But they go to H&R Block or somebody like that and say, you know, what do I do? And same thing we saw in the Small Business Tax Cut. But that's the sort of people who can help promote it and say, hey, if you were saving some money here to put a house, because, you know, everybody wants, I hate to say it, most people, there are some who don't want it, but most people want to own a house. And it's really, I mean, it's the lower income people, well below the 84,000, which includes legislators these days, by the way, that, you know, are going to be impacted by this. And that's who I see it helping. I haven't even looked at the report. I just, anecdotal and looking in my communities and the rural portions of it, that this sort of thing would help. And I didn't know anything about it until we got here. So, you know, I'm not one of the 750 people who got $750,000, according to some of this testimony, to go lobby for this. I mean, first time I ever heard about this bill is right here. And I still think it's a good idea for rural Oregon.
Thank you, sir. While we were listening and discussing this, I asked Christine to do a preliminary numbers crunch on this revenue impact. How'd you do?
Mr. Chair, I came up with about $35 million per biennium, just as a very rough cut at what the impacts might be. I kind of looked at what people were able to put into the 529 plan and considered different aspects of the population. You know, people were a bit more likely to go to or buy a home than to go to college, so inflated it somewhat for that. Yeah.
$35 million in a biennium. Okay. We'll end on that note. Thanks for the discussion on all of these bills today. It was a good day here. And until tomorrow at 8:30, we are adjourned.
Same line.
8:30, we are adjourned.